Hebrews chapter 12. This part of the chapter I reserved for this week because he definitely covers something different. We've been learning in the book of Hebrews. We're going to be in verse number 12 as well. Hebrews 12, 12, and then to the end of the chapter. In the book of Hebrews, we've learned that Jesus is better. He's better than all the heroes of our past that we've looked forward to in the past. All the people that we have followed, we've learned about, whether it is in the Bible or whether it was the Jews who were the recipients of the book. And they had heard of these heroes in their past, and they looked toward them. He's better than their Old Testament system that they had embedded in their lives, traditions and rituals. And God had commanded them these things. God had commanded them these things at Mount Sinai, and they had taken them. But all of these things were just shadows. They were pointers to Jesus. And Jesus was a better of all of those things that they were deciding between. Do I follow Jesus or do I stick with the system? Do I follow Jesus or do I stick with the community? And that was the biggest decision. By the way, it's harder for us to maybe appreciate the difficulty that the Jews had. We live in a very individualistic society. Be your own person, and that's lauded as a virtue. Well, in a lot of Eastern societies and in Middle Eastern societies like Israel, being your own person was not a virtue. If you abandon the community, that's a bad thing. If you abandon the family, you abandon the village, you abandon those around you, you have responsibility to them. And what Jesus is trying to say to those people is that your biggest responsibility is not to the community you just happen to be in, but the community that you have now, which is the church. And that's why he says in chapter 10, we shouldn't forsake the assembling of ourselves together. You want to be faithful to the community? You have a community you need to be faithful to. And so they were deciding between these things, and all these things point to Jesus. All those things they were holding on to in the system, Jesus was a better high priest. He was a better tabernacle. He brought a better covenant. He was a better sacrifice. But he gets in the end of the book, and he says that this is not a mindset. This is a lifestyle. This is not just something that we stick in our mind. Okay, yeah, Jesus is better. There is something that is required of us in response. And so he turns to Hebrews chapter 11 and he says, all these things, the shadows, but faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. He gives us examples of all the Old Testament people. They lifted up how they followed. But these people followed while they lived in those shadows of the law and in the shadows of Jesus that he cast on the Old Testament, without seeing the promises, seeing them afar off. And if they lived faithful then certainly we must be faithful now. And that's where he gets to chapter 12, which is where we were last week. And in chapter 12, he says, so if we've been compassed by so great a cloud of witnesses, then we should run our race. And so just as they were faithful even in the shadows of the Old Testament and with the promises afar off, then we have a course set before us. Having seen the promises, living in the substance of the gospel of Jesus Christ, having all these things being revealed to us, and not everything, but certainly much more than they had, we should run our course. And Jesus summons us to run our race. And many of these Jews and many of the Christians who would read this book in the centuries following the writing of the book would choose not to. They would choose not to serve. They would choose not to follow. And so our message today is, don't disobey God's summons to run your race. He tells you, okay, now all of this concludes with, how should you live your life? What decisions do you make? God has set a course before you in light of all of these truths, and what will you do with it? And he tells us to run our race. Go back to verse number 1 before we get to our verse 12. Verse number 1, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And he goes on to say that God will chastise us if he must. He will train. He will discipline. Which is a help. Just like training and discipline is good if you're going to prepare to run an actual race here on earth, then training and discipline is good if you're going to run your race of life. And so he gets to the end. Look at verse number 12, which is where we're going to begin this morning. Verse 12. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. It says, be strong Stay committed. Verse 13. Make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Mark your course, run your course, stay on your course. Verse 14. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Practice the lifestyle of the Christian race, peace with each other, being set apart to God. This is the way that we run. But many of us who are living our lives the way we please are forgetting about the fact that God has set a course before us and we are responsible to follow it. This is not an option he's presenting before us as something that you could do, although it is a choice that we have to make. It's not presented as an option. Okay, now you're a Christian and maybe you could live as a Christian if you wanted to. That's not how the Bible presents these things. As a follower of Christ, we're responsible to follow Christ. We want to be called followers of Jesus and not actually follow Jesus. We want to be given the title of Christian and not actually do what it means to be a Christian. And so we are responsible to follow that. And there's sacrifice involved with that to a certain extent. And we could argue about whether or not it's really a sacrifice, but that's a different message. But the point is, there's change involved. Learning, growing, repentance. And all of that is just really inconvenient, isn't it? And so we think we might just stop running our race. So we stop serving. We stop giving. We stop following. We stop learning. We stop growing. Because, you know, it's hard. And it's inconvenient. And I got my own stuff going on. And the problem is, I don't think many of us realize the tight spot that we put ourselves in. We don't realize that it's actually a big deal for a Christian who calls himself a follower of Jesus to not follow Jesus. If you are in danger of leaving your race, we have to remember that there is a danger in leaving the race. If we are in danger of leaving our race, we have to recognize that there is a danger in leaving the race. And that's why that's where we are here in the end of chapter 12. This is the fifth warning passage of the book. Throughout the book, he's given us truths, and then he has paused what he's talked about to a certain extent, sometimes more than others, and he's kind of applied it to us, almost speaking to the person who's thinking, maybe I won't do that. So he talks in chapter 1 about how we need to recognize that Jesus is better, and then he says, but if God didn't spare the angels which sinned, I mean, how much more loss there would be in our life if we neglect our great salvation. So we should trust that Jesus is better. But what if we don't trust that Jesus is better? Well, in chapter 3, he says, well, then just like the Israelites didn't get to enjoy the promised land, then you won't enjoy the rest and the peace that God has for you. Well, does it matter? It does matter. Well, what if I don't grow? Well, we're supposed to move on to perfection. I mean, we can't go back and forth this whole salvation thing and get saved and unsaved and then resaved again. But the thing is, there's so much that we're losing out on, chapter 6. What about chapter 10? What if I don't follow Jesus? Well, you're not going to find anything that Jesus gives in the place where Jesus is not. And here we are in chapter 12. He said, what if I don't run my race? What if I just decide not to? I mean, we follow the God of the New Testament. And the God of the New Testament is the God of love and grace and mercy. And what we mean by that is the God of the New Testament cares less. That's what we mean by that. Because that's what we actually think. It mattered in the Old Testament when they were obedient. It doesn't matter in the New Testament when we're not. He gets to chapter 12 and he gives us some warnings for those who are in danger of running their race. So first warning, part of the warning. Number one, be careful of the pitfalls. Be careful of the pitfalls. Why would you stop running your race? I mean, we could talk about several. These are just a couple examples he gives. I mean, one of the major ones throughout the whole book gives us is when we are more concerned about what people think about us, or if we're more concerned about our earthly community instead of our heavenly community, that we will abandon them for the sake of what we're comfortable to. And so that there's that. But he provides a couple of ones. There's always pitfalls in our race. When I wrote that down, the first thing that popped into my mind was when I was a kid, I loved to play this computer game called Pitfall. That's why it came into my mind. It was an old game, and it was much really vamped up into a much better quality in the 1990s when it hit a golden era. And so you're a guy, you're running through the jungle, right? Because you're going to go save your dad from this, you know, stone man that captured him. And there's lots of pitfalls, you know, monkeys and warthogs and holes that open up in the ground and waterfalls, etc. And you have to be aware of all of them. And if any one of those pitfalls, then you would lose the game. And the thing is, he tells us here, in your course, there's a lot of things that will cause you to get off of your race. We don't even recognize them. And he's going to give us a couple here in this passage. Letter A, one of the pitfalls we can have is leaving the sufficiency of Jesus for the sufficiency of self. Leaving the sufficiency of Jesus for the sufficiency of self. Now, this is a little bit, it's not readily obvious because of the terminology he uses, and so we tend to gloss over it, but there's a very important principle here. Verse 15. So he moves on, he describes what we should do. We should be strong, we should stay committed, we should live the Christian life. And verse 15 is where he starts to really begin his warning. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. Now we're going to pause there for a second. We're going to pick that up here in just a second. But at first, it almost appears that this verse is saying that if you don't do enough, you will fail to earn God's grace. But the thing is, that would be, even if you could say that that's what the verse says, that would be kind of a contradictory statement, because grace by definition is not earned. But it doesn't say you fail to earn, it just says you will fail of the grace of God. The word fail more has the idea of not failing to achieve, but falling back from. And for these Jews, this was their dilemma. Do I continue in my Christian life, or do I fall back into my former life? Now for them it was religious, so it was still good in their mind. But for many of us, it might not be religion. It might be just our old way of living. We fall back from what we've had. And he says, what are we falling back from? The grace of God. All the things that God has given to us, all the things that we've learned over the course of the last few chapters, all that Jesus is to us, and all that he does for our lives that nothing else can do, if we choose to go our way, we fall back from that. Now, whether it is salvation, where we choose not to accept it or not, or just to live the Christian life, mankind seems to be incurably self-reliant, don't we? We trust ourselves. We trust our abilities. We trust our holiness. We trust our wisdom more than anything else that we are familiar with. We will do it on our own, or we will not do it at all. Rather than growing in grace, we attempt to grow in self. If we do not live the Christian life in Christ's way, what we're really doing is living the self life, even if we're trying to be religious while we do it. So even when we are religious, rather than finding Jesus, we simply find ourselves. And he says we fail of the grace of God. Rather than holding on to who God is and what he does for us, we just make ourselves more of us. We make ourselves more. There's more self-glory. We are sufficient more of ourselves. We have done it. We have grown. We have produced what we could have done in our own life. But look how he continues this. Verse 15. I emphasize this because of what he quotes here, which is also not readily obvious. Verse 15. Looking diligently, lest any man fail the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Now, the idea of bitterness, we just assume, means that we're upset about something and we haven't stopped being upset about something. That's what we mean by bitterness. But he's actually quoting something here, and I think I gave it to you. Did I give it to you? Deuteronomy 29? Did I do that? Okay, this is actually where he's quoting. It's not readily obvious because sometimes in the New Testament it'll say bitterness, and sometimes in the Old Testament it'll say gall or wormwood, which is all the same. I want us to read what he quoted, because there's a very interesting statement he makes in the middle, which is apropos to the point we're making. Verse 18 of Deuteronomy 29. This is what he quotes. Lest there be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations. Lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. That's what he just quoted. A root of bitterness that troubles you. But look what he says in verse 19 of these people. These people have bitterness in their heart. Doesn't mean they're upset about something. They've been defiled by this mindset. Verse 19. And it come to pass when he heareth the words of this curse, the people that have turned from God, look what it says. that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of mine heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. Now I'm going to come back to that. Verse 20, the Lord will not spare him, but then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy shall smoke against that man, and all the curses that are written in this book shall lie upon him. So what does it say there in the middle? So I've chosen not to follow the Lord, and so now I've been defiled. My heart is filled with bitterness, gall, wormwood. And so he says, so I will not bless you. I will curse you. And what does the man say in response to that? Oh, no problem. I shall bless myself. Did you see that in verse 19? When he will curse you, he will bless himself in his heart, saying what? I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of my heart. God doesn't need to help me. I will help myself. God helps those who help themselves. That's not in the Bible anywhere. The opposite of that is in the Bible. It even says this at the end. Now, we miss this too because of the terminology. To add drunkenness to thirst. We see drunkenness and we assume that we're inebriated. But to be drunken sometimes in the Bible means to be filled with so much that I overflow. To thirst. So what is he saying? If I am thirsty, then I shall quench my own thirst. That's the idea of that. I have been cursed. I will bless myself. In spite of the fact that I walk in the imagination of my heart. This is the passage that he quoted in Hebrews chapter 12. You don't want to run your race? Be careful, because some of you are having that defiled mindset in your heart. I shall bless myself. Who needs God's course when I can just make my own course? I know where I will go. I will, today or tomorrow, we'll go into such a city. We'll continue their year and buy and sell and get gain. I have everything planned out and it will be great. I've decided what I'm going to do, how long I'm going to do it, what's going to happen, and how it will all turn out. I've written it all. I shall bless myself. And he says, when you leave the sufficiency of Jesus for the sufficiency of self, there is a problem. Not just a problem of your heart, but a problem in your outcome, because it does not turn out the way that you think that it does. Jesus is better than you. And some of us are yet to be convinced of that. Leaving sufficiency of Jesus for the sufficiency of self. We're not getting really far, are we? Letter B. Leaving the satisfaction of Jesus for the pleasures of the world. Leaving the satisfaction of Jesus for the pleasures of the world. One of the ways that we do this is by seeking fulfillment somewhere other than in Jesus Christ and in his gracious gifts that he's given to us. So he continues, verse 16. Lest, run your race, be careful, stay your course, but there could be, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. I gave you the passages, I didn't intend to read them, but they're there in your notes if you want to go back and read the story. The story is simple, and we probably know the story. The Israelites certainly knew the story, so he didn't have to elaborate on it. That automatically got imported into the text. He says, a profane person. The word profane literally means heathenish. So they act like the world. That's what it means. Now, this is the story. We might know the story, but just in case, let's put it back into our minds, because this is what he's saying many of us will do. The story goes like this. Esau was the firstborn. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. They were twins. Now, to be the firstborn was not just that you got bragging rights and you could tell your younger sibling what to do sometimes if they would happen to listen. The firstborn actually had culturally a lot of significance to it. You had a spiritual blessing. You became the patriarch of the family. You were the spiritual leader. You not only had that opportunity, you had that responsibility. And so Jacob would be following Esau's lead. That was part of it. There was also a material blessing. So if you had, you got twice as much as the rest of your siblings did as the firstborn. With you being the patriarch, you had more responsibility. You got more resources to do that. Okay? So if you get twice as much, then that means if there's two children, that means Isaac's estate would be separated into three parts. Esau would get two, and Jacob would get one. So he would get twice as much. Now, if you had Jacob and you had all 12 of your sons, then you would just get twice as many of the rest of them. So it wouldn't be as big of a difference, but it would be some. We need to talk about that. The point is, that was his birthright. By right of his birth, it belonged to him. So Esau goes out one day, the story goes, and he's hunting out in the field. He's hungry. He comes back. Jacob's in the tent. He's cooking food. He asks his brother, can I have some food? And Jacob goes, oh, I don't even know if Jacob, by the way, thought that Esau would be so stupid to give in to this deal. I don't think he was joking, but I don't think he was entirely expecting Esau to give in to it. But he says, if you sell me your birthright, Esau, if you give away literally the most precious thing that you have been given in life, I shall give you a bowl of lentil soup. I've said this before, nobody even liked lentils. You ever notice that at the store? They don't even try to make the package of lentils interesting. They just say lentils, because if you buy lentils, you're going to buy them. They're not going to entice anybody in the store. Well, that looks good, and you stick it in your cart. That's what he was serving that day. But he was so hungry, he said, well, if I'm going to die, what's the birthright going to do for me? And so for one morsel of meat, he sold away the most precious thing that he had. Our fellows are coming by. If you could drop your attendant slip in, we'd appreciate that. Just so we know who else is here. So, verse 17, look how it goes on with the story. The whole story's there in two verses. For ye know how that when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. Later on, he wanted to be blessed. Jacob tricked his father into giving it to him, but at the end of the day, it belonged to Jacob already because Esau had sold it. And so he wanted it back. Wait, no, no, just kidding. I didn't mean it. Now I want all of those precious things that I sold away. The fact that his deal was a really, really, really bad deal didn't change the fact that he still gave it away. And so we read the story of Esau, and it bewildered us to think that for a moment of temporary fleshly satisfaction, he would give away the most precious things that he was given. But some people are like Esau, and they will sell away their purity. They will sell away their family. They will sell away their ministry for an affair. Sometimes one night, sometimes one moment, sometimes not even affair, sometimes just a really, really stupid text message. And for a morsel of meat, they will sell away their birthright. Some of us, people are selling away their jobs and ministries so they can have a few more dollars that they stole or embezzled or cheated. Or maybe they sell away their jobs and their ministry because they didn't get their way. And so for a moment of fleshly satisfaction, they will give away some of the most precious things that they've been given. Some people are selling their relationship with God, being pure, because they want to entertain wicked thoughts in their life. Maybe they're lustful, maybe they're bitter, or maybe they're angry thoughts. But for the most precious things they've been given, they will sell it away for temporary amount of satisfaction. And Jesus is saying this, God has set before you a course. He has set before you a hard course, a difficult course. There's a lot that it requires of you sometimes. Sacrifice, change, learning, growing, chastisement. But it is a blessed course. It is a beautiful course. It is a course that is the only way to true satisfaction and the only way to life. And some of you are selling it away for stupid stuff. Just like Esau, you all sat with your kids around the fireplace and told them about really, really dumb Esau. And some of you are doing the same thing. God has set before you a life, and we are selling it away for temporary, stupid stuff. And we get so enticed by the world as if it's important. And I bet you a few hours later, that bowl of lentil soup didn't seem nearly as valuable as he made it to be. And we elevate the value of the things of the world to a place that is just obscene, as if it actually has significance when it just really doesn't. Be careful of those pitfalls that for some reason we find ourselves falling into, to leave our course. For the sake of what? A bowl of soup? A little bit of satisfaction for ourselves? Be careful of the pitfalls. Number two. Okay. He makes one point in all of this, so I'm going to try to make it one point. Number two, recognize the danger of leaving your race. What we see with the first section is loss. But in addition to loss, what he adds in the second section is accountability. I'm going to go through this quickly because I didn't know how to outline it without making it like structurally pleasing. So, but we'll make it quick. Letter A. We worship on a new mountain. He starts to use an illustration that we're going to understand here in just a second. I said a moment ago, we have this idea that the Old Testament God is a God of judgment, and the New Testament God's a God of mercy. There was a bigger consequence to disobeying the Old Testament God than there would be to disobeying the New Testament God. There was more loss if I disobeyed the Old Testament God than there would be if I disobeyed the New Testament God. And what he's about to do in this section is completely throw that idea out of our minds. Because what we then conclude from that was it mattered if I disobeyed then, but it doesn't matter if I leave my course now. So he's going to refer to Mount Sinai. When the children of Israel left Egypt, they entered into a covenant with God. God came to them and gave them the law. He came to them on the top of Mount Sinai, and when he did, he was physically present. His presence descended on it, and so there was fire, there was earthquakes, there was voices. It was loud, it was scary, and the people didn't like it. This is the presence of God, and it really personifies the idea that we have of God and his judgment and his wrath and how it mattered whether or not they responded to him. But number one, they rejected God's presence before. They rejected God's presence before. I'm going to give you a couple reasons why. Letter A, because they did not like his influence. They rejected his presence before because they did not like his influence. Verse number 18. So this is where he begins this illustration. For ye are not come. We're going to get to where we have come in a second. But he's saying they're not come there because the Old Testament Jews, they did. You're not come unto the mount that might be touched and that burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest. All the things he's describing about the mountain. And the sound of a trumpet, verse 19. And the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them anymore. You could see God's influence on the mountain. There was lightning, there was thunders, there was earthquakes, there was fire, there was voices. And they said, he was just so there. They didn't want to hear his voice anymore. His influence was just so much in their life that it scared them. And this is true for us. God can be just a little bit much for us sometimes. We like that still, small voice God that we can ignore if we choose to. We like that, hey, if you want to follow me, then you can. We like that God who's at an arm's length, that we can keep our distance if we want to, or not, depending on whether or not we're having a bad day. That's the God that we often look for. That's not the God that they had. And when that's the God that they had, and he was just so there, they asked him to go away. They didn't like his influence. Letter B, they did not like his commands. Look how he describes. Why did they say that those words he spoke should not be spoken? Verse 3, for they could not endure that which was commanded. So he hears God talking and talking. And the more he talks, the more they're expected to do. And so just if you stop communicating to us, the less I will be required to obey. They could not endure that which was commanded. No, I bet you that if the Bible was nothing else but a treatise of explaining angels and demons and end times, every Christian would have read it long before now. But the Bible's not a treatise about angels and demons. In fact, angels and demons are really almost never the point of the story at all. End times is a very important topic in the Bible, but not the only one. Now, the Bible is a story about how our relationship with God has been broken, how Jesus has made it right, and how we are expected to live. And he speaks, and there are over 1,000 pages of words that he has spoken to us, and many of them require more of us, and so many of us just don't seem to ever quite find the time to hear them, do we? Because we're busy. We wouldn't be busy if it didn't tell us what to do, but we are busy when it tells us what we are expected to do. We cannot endure his commandments, and so we ask that the word not be spoken to them anymore. They did not like his commands. Letter C, because they were afraid of the consequences. They were afraid of the consequences. They didn't want God's presence there because they realized that to disobey him was a big deal. Look at what he continues, verse 20. They could not adore that which is commanded, and if so much as a beast touch the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with a dart. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. It was a fearful thing to disobey God in the Old Testament. Not because he was just so there and his presence was available, but because the wages of disobeying was often death. And sometimes we feel like God's really harsh, as if we expect him to tell us exactly how to live and also tell us that we actually really don't have to do any of it. That's what we want. This would be best, but if not, you know, that's cool. You just do you. That's what we want from God. We don't want there to be chastisement or training or discipline or consequences at all. We want to do as we please and God to be there when we want him to be. And so with the words he speaks to us, we tell them to stop. Well, that was the Old Testament, and God was just so there. But we serve the God of the New Testament. Number two, but we have a better presence of God now. That whole section you just reminded us about, when the children of Israel came to the base of Mount Sinai and he was there and it just shook the mountain. You know how he started that? You have not come to that mountain. Yeah, I know. Good. Whew. Because that would have been a scary thing. But where have we come to? Verse 22. We've come to a place, letter A, with greater influence. Do you really think that the New Testament culminated with God being further away than he was in the Old Testament? The exact opposite is true. God had to put systems of barriers and walls between them and his presence. God's presence was unavailable. They weren't allowed to touch the mountain. Only Moses was allowed to go up into the mountain. And this whole book has been to tell us that the God of the Old Testament is more available to us now than he was before. Look at what he says, verse 22. We're not come to that mountain, verse 22, but ye are come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels. Is that supposed to be less? Less of God's presence? Jesus has made us a way to enter into the holiest of all. We've already read that. Hebrews chapter 9 tells us that these patterns of things that we saw on the earth, they were of heavenly things. Christ has not entered into the heavenly places made with hands. They're the figures of the true. He's entered into heaven itself. Hebrews 4 tells us that we should come boldly unto the throne of grace. All of this book has been there to remind us that Jesus had made a way for us to God. Not a way for God's shadow to be cast on a mountain somewhere, but for us to be with him. And his presence lives not just with us, his presence lives in you, John chapter 16. And so in 1 Corinthians 6, that's why he calls you the temple of the Holy Spirit. We are the temple of the Holy Spirit. God dwells with us. If it mattered when God's presence was on Mount Sinai, it matters more when we can enter into the holiest of all. We have a better presence, letter B, with greater commands. With greater commands. Well, they did not endure his commands. God expects less out of us in the New Testament than he did in the Old. You see, that's just not true. Well, didn't we get rid of some laws? Okay, yes. We can eat chicken. Certain feast days and structures that were there to point to Jesus are not really necessary anymore. When we have the substance, we don't need the shadows. And that's true. But in regards to being a follower of God, is there less or more that he expects? Wait, what if we just turn to the last couple pages of our book? And how Abraham had faith, and Enoch had faith, and Isaac had faith. And then it says, and these all had faith, seeing the promises afar off. So if we just take that and apply it to us, we should expect that there be more expected of us. But the fact is, we just have to look into the Gospels and look what Jesus said. Hey, you've heard that it was said by them of old time, but I say unto you, You shall not commit adultery. Hey, so I don't cheat on my wife, I'm good. But if any man look upon a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery with her already in his heart. You know what he did? He took the Old Testament and said, you're expected more than that. You're expected more than just outward conformity. He wants to change you and change your heart. Well, haven't we already read that in Hebrews chapter 8? Where he says that the old covenant was a list of rules and structures and rituals, but he wants to actually change who you are. There's greater commands that he gives to us. Look at verse 23. We've come to that mountain, verse 23, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better things than of Abel. Abel, being dead, yet speaketh, Jesus speaketh greater things because he was being dead and he rose again. We can leave that one alone. The point is, here he makes, he's mediator of a new covenant, a better covenant, the one who's changing your hearts. It takes that heart of stone and makes it a heart of flesh, the one who writes his law on your hearts. This is what he expects of us now. He expects us to not just be conformed, he expects us to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. There's not less here. There's more that he's given to us. Let her see. With greater consequences. If there's less of God's presence and lower commands, then there was lower consequences. But if there's a greater presence and greater commands, then there's more loss. No, that's not true. Well, let's read. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh. For if they escape not who refuse him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven. If it mattered then certainly it matters now. If we would look back in the Old Testament and judge all the kings and priests, well, he should have been a better king, and they left it, and they lived in the shadows, and somehow extrapolate that out to our life and make it that we're not expected to follow God, then we've missed the entire story of the Bible. And if they were required to follow God who descended with his shadow on a mountain, then if we can have the presence of God living in our hearts, then there is much more to be lost if we don't live the life that he's given to us. It matters if we run our race. Now, this is a warning passage, and he's always very direct when he gives a warning passage. We hear run our race, it's like, well, it would be good if I got around to that. He says, no, it matters. It matters more than it ever has before. And so this is not something to toss away in exchange for something else. This is the point. And so if we miss it, we miss why we're here. And that's a big deal. It matters. Letter B. He gives one more point before he's done. Two more points before he's done. Letter B. God's kingdom is all that will last. Now, he talked about how his voice shook the earth. He's going to use the picture in your mind, in the Jewish mind, of all the stories. The picture they had in their minds of God's presence descending on a single mountain and shaking. He's going to use that picture and apply it to what Jesus will do. Verse 26, whose voice then shook the earth? But now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved. I'm going to pause there, because that's the point we're going to make before we finish. He simply makes a simple, simple point. As his voice shook on earth, put that picture in your mind. Once more, he will shake not only earth, but he will shake heaven. And everything that can be shaken apart will. And the only thing that cannot be shaken and broken will remain. And what is the thing that remains when everything else falls? Verse 28, we receive a kingdom which cannot be moved. This world will fall apart. Everything you live for, it will all be gone. That car that you just bought will rust, and it might not even last the next 10 years, but it's not going to last into eternity. All the things that we live for, we work for, we strive for, we put in our lives to make ourselves look good in front of our neighbors and our family, all of those things will be shaken and they will fall apart. And after all of it falls, only one thing will remain, and in his kingdom. And so the question is, are we living for the kingdom or not? Because if we live for anything but that, if we run our course for any other goal but Christ, we are running towards something that when we get there, it will not be there. And we will have lost. We will have lost. I can read the passages, but in 2 Peter, he says, seeing that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be? In all holy conversation and godliness. Well, you can read the rest of that passage. He was like, if you're going to see all these things are going to be dissolved, it's going to change the way that you live. If you recognize that only one thing will remain, then you will look for something different. He says the same thing in Matthew chapter 6. Many of you are laying up for yourselves treasures on this earth, and everything will fall apart. So lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, in the place that is the only thing that will remain. He says, if you run your course for anything but the kingdom of God, you're running it for something that will not exist once you arrive. God's kingdom is the only thing that will remain. And lastly, with that whole picture in their mind, he says, this same God expects our faithfulness. We are so removed from the Old Testament that we say, oh, I don't serve that God anymore. And we say, well, no, he is the same God. And we know that theologically. But practically, we think it doesn't matter to this God, even though it mattered to that one. And he says, that is not true. We serve the same God. And if it matters more now, then that should go into the equation of what kind of decisions you make this week. Verse 28, wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Why do I have to serve God with reverence and godly fear? Because I serve the same God on that mountain. And our God is a consuming fire. That's how he finishes chapter 12. He wants you to think very seriously. He's not trying to scare you. He's trying to deal with reality. It matters. God is not sitting up in heaven saying, well, I'm glad the Old Testament is over, so now I don't have to care anymore. It matters. And the same God who chastises and trains is the God who promises that the wages of sin is death. And he might not kill you, but the more sin we allow in our life, the more death we put in our life. The more we strive for something that doesn't last for eternity, the less our lives are falling apart because we are filling our lives with things that fall apart. And he says, the God that we serve is the same God from there, but has given us so much more that we can enjoy, which means there's so much more to be wasted and lost if we don't. So run your race. Because it matters if you do. We're going to read chapter 13 next week, and we will finish the book of Hebrews as he finishes.